The Tom Woods Show, episode 2114.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined once again by our friend Todd Zwicky, who's a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. And he became a bit of a celebrity when he sued the university over the vaccine mandate there. And he had some success in that. So I want to talk to him about that. But ever since then, he's been just a veritable lion on Twitter when it comes to these topics. He's been very outspoken, very sound. I've been promoting his commentary quite a bit myself. And I thought it was about time we spoke again. So, Todd, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
Things have changed a teensy-weensy bit since May 2019 when you were last on the show.
Right.
And I was just looking at the topic we covered, and it had to do with Bernie and AOC and what they want to do with regard to capping interest rates on credit cards. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that topic. That's a perfectly legitimate topic for anyone, libertarians included, to talk about. But it just seems so quaintly naive compared to what we have to talk about now.
That's right. Do you remember back when we thought that was one of the biggest threats to the free society and economy?
Yeah, I know it. I know. It's absolutely crazy. So I've been following your Twitter feed pretty closely over these past couple of years because, man, you have just been on fire. I've retweeted you I don't know how many times. I haven't seen a single thing I've disagreed with that you've written about this whole crazy thing. But of course, what you're associated with now is not that work on credit card interest rates, but the fact that you actually were involved in a lawsuit because you said you had natural immunity and there's no reason you should be required to take these shots. So how'd that come about? At what point did you say, I'm actually going to have to sue because they're really not going to make provision for me?
That's right, Tom. Yeah, and that's basically how it played out, which is the science, you know, sort of the magical science, according to our public health authorities, changed very quickly, you know, which is right from the beginning, we always understood, or at least we thought we understood, that natural immunity was highly protective against COVID. And in fact, even Anthony Fauci himself said in March 2020 that I would bet anything that if you had contracted COVID, you would be protected against getting COVID again. So I was an early adopter of COVID. I got COVID right at the beginning of March 2020. I had been up at a conference in New York at the Classical Liberal Center with Richard Epstein and Mario Rizzo. And I hung around Penn Station for a couple hours waiting for a train back to DC. And in retrospect, COVID was probably about the fifth most dangerous thing I was exposed to in Penn Station, hanging around for a few hours. But the next week, I popped up with these very weird symptoms that weren't considered COVID symptoms at the time. I couldn't get tested. But a few weeks later, they were recognized as symptoms. And so came around that summer, and I wanted to teach in person. I was willing to volunteer to teach in person that fall because I figured that's my job. So I got my antibodies tested by giving blood at the American Red Cross. My antibodies came back positive. I said, okay, all right, I've got it. I'm protected. This is what the science says. So I taught all of the year, 2020, 2021 school year, in person. I volunteered to teach in person and actually taught an overload at the law school. And so then at the end of that year, I'd already had COVID. I was waiting for the rest of the world to catch up. The vaccines came out. I was like, okay, great. We'll be able to get back to normal because people will get to where I was. And then sure enough, the president of the university just decrees that everybody has to get a COVID vaccine. And I said, well, this doesn't make any sense. Obviously, this is a university, so all I have to do is show them the science, right, Tom?
And yeah, so, that's it. That's all it takes. And everybody will be reasonable.
That's right, because it's a university. They care about what the science actually shows. I was like, oh, okay, all right, well, I'll just show them my antibody test. I had multiple antibody tests that came back positive during that year. You know, every time I would give blood, I would get an antibodies test. So I had this unbroken string of several antibodies tests going back a year. So I explained this to the people designing the George Mason policy, and they just brushed me off, right? Just came back with some garbage answer. And I was like, oh, I see what we're up against here. We're up against university bureaucracy. So the first time I contacted them politely and asked them to consider it, the second time I contacted them through my lawyers at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, I thought maybe that would get their attention. I said,
and by the way, is that Janine Yunus?
Exactly right.
So I've had her as a guest. She's been on this podcast. Yeah.
And they've been warriors on this stuff, as you know, Tom. Yeah, Janine was my lawyer. And so we contacted them and said, please reconsider this policy or you're going to be sued. They just blew us off, ignored it, issued their policy. And then, you know, about 2 weeks later, we had to sue them. That was the only way I could get them to pay attention. Eventually, they essentially backed down and gave me a medical exemption on some other reasons rather than natural immunity related, basically so that they could avoid giving it to anybody else. And of course, what we've learned since that time, of course, is that natural immunity is really robust. I don't think at this point there's really any doubt that natural immunity is both more protective, more durable than vaccination. I think that's pretty well established at this point. And so sort of everything I said at the time turned out to be true. And that's when I started kind of getting involved in the COVID wars. So
that's unbelievable. I mean, now, so I don't want you to mention any names. And I know you're at the law school, which is different from being at the undergraduate college. But
right.
What was the reaction from your colleagues? I mean, have you been shunned over this?
No, it's funny, Tom. You know, I teach at the Anthony Scalia Law School, and there's a reason why I teach there is that I have incredible colleagues. We are known as sort of the mothership of law and economics, for example. I am blessed that I have colleagues who, number one, believe in individual liberty, and number two, believe in data, right? And they basically heard my argument. They respected, even if they disagreed with me, they respected me for my position and understood why I thought it was important. But a lot of them basically, they looked at the data, they looked at what I was saying, and they said, you're right, this is at least as protective. As one of my colleagues said after I gave a presentation at the law school to the Federal Society, he said, I only have one question, which is, where do I go to get my money back on my vaccine? So,
oh.
But I suffered no blowback at all from my colleagues at the law school. And, you know, I'm proud to say that about the most common question I get now was from potential applicants telling me that they wanted to come to George Mason Law School. So, because I was one of the few law professors out there taking a stand. So,
yeah,
it's been
good,
a very gratifying
good.
Experience. So,
that is very good. That is very good. Yeah. What area of law do you specialize in?
So, I primarily specialize in consumer finance and law and economics. And so, this was all new to me. But, Tom, I'm a Hayekian, right? I've been studying evolutionary thinking and spontaneous order for a long time. And going back to this marvelous book by Matt Ridley called The Red Queen, which I recommend to anybody, it's a great introduction to all virology and that sort of thing, right? But the immune system and evolutionary biology are these remarkable complex adaptive orders and evolutionary systems. And so through my exposure to Hayek, I kind of understood all this sort of stuff, how this all works. And so it was all very accessible to me when I started doing this. And really the reason I started doing this, Thomas, because nobody else was. The cowardice of America's medical profession is just heartbreaking. I mean, it's just, you know, the number of doctors who willingly just fell in line. And I was lucky. I found this doctor of all things on Twitter, Hooman Norchasm, this remarkably courageous guy who is not only a great doctor and immunologist, he's trained to get his PhD in immunology, but also a patient's right advocate, going back to for some personal reasons. And I sent him an email and said, I think I'm going to have to sue my university about this. Can you help me? And he responded immediately. And he was an expert witness for me. And Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff, who I'm sure you and your listeners know, were also gracious enough to be expert witnesses for me. And one of the reasons I pushed this, Tom, was not just about me. It was about the principle. I saw where this was going. And I understood that this needed to be challenged with a sophisticated lawsuit because as you and your listeners are aware, a lot of judges have been missing in action during this. And I, frankly, other than the Trump judges have been totally courageous and warriors during this time, the Bush and Obama judges have just been pathetic. They've just rolled over, right? And so, you know, like Judge Mizell, who stood up against the mask mandate last week. But what I understood was that in order to push back against the deference that judges were giving to these public health politicians, you had to have the right case with the right plaintiff presented in the right way. And so a lot of people said, well, why are you just focused on natural immunity? Why are you focused on antibodies? And I said, because I think that's the only case that can possibly win, right? Which is judges have been so deferential. You have to be very strategic about kind of creating a chink in the armor, right? Where you can say, this is a case that can be won, and I am the plaintiff who has the right characteristics, the right, you know, antibodies, the right understanding of this case. And so that was one of the things that was very gratifying working with Janine and NCLA was kind of putting this together. And one of the things I wanted to do was provide a template for other cases. And as you know, a lot of other cases followed subsequently. So,
well, it's interesting you put it this way, because the issue of masks, of course, has been front and center for quite a while. And we just had that ruling about the transportation mask mandate. Right. And I know there were some people on, let's say, our side of things who were disappointed by the reasoning in the case, that it was just procedural. Well, if only the government had done it this way rather than that, then it would be okay, as opposed to saying, well, they're just not allowed to do this. But just the way the world works these days, if you want to win the case, you have to argue it in the way that's most likely to win. And unfortunately, that is the way that's most likely to win. I mean, you could sit here and argue about what the original meaning of the Interstate Commerce Clause is. You know, right. That just doesn't go anywhere. It's not going to stick.
Trying to tame the administrative state through the rule of law is going to take a long time. It's going to be very difficult. And so you're right. So in the short run, what you have to do, as we've understood, is you have to create winning precedents, right? And so there was a case, for example, that was brought before my case. And one of the reasons I brought my case, rather than just trying to get a narrow exemption or something like that, like some people did, one of the reasons I brought the case was, there had been a case that was brought prior to my case, which was just a head-on attack on vaccine mandates. And the case just got totally blown out of the water, created a terrible precedent at the time, and it reaffirmed all the bad precedents that go back a long time. And I thought, you know, this is an uphill struggle. But fighting against the administrative state is an uphill struggle, and you've got to do it in a case-by-case analysis. You know, the classic example of this, of course, that's always been the case study for those of our law professors was the NAACP's litigation to break down desegregation during the civil rights era, which is one case after another, building a precedent that will expose the incoherence of the policies that then allow you to build on that particular precedent. So that's what I was trying to do. I have no idea whether it would end up winning, right? I ended up, my case went away. But I knew that anything else was going to lose, and this seemed like the best chance we'd have of winning.
Right before all this happened, I was thinking academia was just a toxic place to be, even though I spent a good chunk of my life there as an undergraduate and then as a faculty member. And I think there's a lot to recommend it. Certainly as a career, there's plenty to recommend it. For heaven's sake, I felt like I was being paid to read books and to write about things that I found interesting and to travel to conferences. And I mean, this is a nerd's dream, you know?
But, that's right.
But all the same, by the time we got to just before this whole thing broke out, just the, you know what it's like. I mean, of course, your campus is very, very different, but I'm sure you know the stories of uniformity of thought, demonization of dissidents. And even when I would get speaking engagements, you know, now as a civilian now, I just didn't want to step foot on these places anymore. But now it seems like with potentially arbitrary commands being handed down to you at a moment's notice, and if you don't abide by them, your career is over. It just seems even worse. And it seems like it's going to drive out even, you know, that relative few people in our camp who might be attracted to academia.
Well, your perception that most universities is toxic is definitely right. Tom, it is still very toxic. You know, the reception I got on my campus from my colleagues is not at all the uniform response, even in my university, right? And we all know how awful most academics are, how they are generally. The way that universities have behaved during this COVID, the crisis, is just appalling. It is just morally outrageous, right? The idea that we had these universities taking healthy 20-year-olds, many who have had COVID, right? And this is one of the points I made at the beginning of my lawsuit, is if you have had COVID and then you get vaccinated, you are at a much higher risk of adverse events, including serious adverse events, and you get no benefit from the shot, right? But they're taking these kids who already, a lot of them who already had COVID, they forced them to get vaccines in the fall. And basically, I know a lot of my students who said, I'm getting the vaccine just because they said, if you don't get vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. Literally like 2 days after the deadline passed, they said, all right, everybody's got to wear a mask anyway. And then these students go home and they come back in January. And on New Year's Eve, it's 7 o'clock p.m. on New Year's Eve, the university sends out a new message that says, well, if you want to enroll for the spring semester, you've got to get a booster shot. Right in the middle of the school year, they're going to change the terms of these for these kids, basically to deal with the neuroticism of these leftist professors on the main campus, the bullying and awful behavior of these administrators. And one of my students, I'm proud to say, immediately called me and he said, Professor, I'm not going to do this. What do I need to do? And I basically said, go get them. And he organized a petition and he organized a rally and started a movement. And eventually, as you know, in Virginia, obviously the governor lifted the mandate for me and eventually the attorney general lifted the mandate for the students. But it's really just appalling. I mean, it's really morally reprehensible behavior what these university administrators have done to these kids who are 19, 20 years old, completely healthy. And on our campus, they've all been vaccinated once, and yet they were still going to go and stick a booster shot in them. It's, you know, not to mention all the other restrictions and everything else on them. If you thought it was toxic when you were in the SUPA, Tom, it's more toxic than it's ever been in most places. I'm just lucky that I live in an oasis of sanity. And
yeah, you really are. You really are. And where's the data on boosters for young people? What are they pointing to? They're just assuming, well, if a couple of shots are good, then more shots must be awesome. Is that really the level? Well, is that the level of thought here?
Yeah, the CDC. Well, we're just following the CDC guidance is what they said. What they said at the time, right? It was as simple-minded as that. So they don't point to any data. It's half the time when they point to data, the data doesn't even make any sense. I have a friend who they had a booster mandate at his school. They sent out a study and the study was completely irrelevant.
Right.
So it's like, and here's how bad it is, Tom, right? Is we're living, and a lot of people have suffered. Can I hear, I've heard from, all during the fall, I would hear from dozens of people every week who are subject to these things. Most already had COVID. They wanted to know, could they get an exemption from their employer? And that sort of, all these sorts of things are trying to push back. They were afraid. They realized how irrational all this different stuff was. And it was just like talking into a void. And one of the things I discovered that's really creepy about all of this is we kind of live under the tyranny of the human resource office at this point. So many Americans, which is George Mason, for example, the COVID policy was designed, and I'm not making this up, Tom, by the fire chief of the university and the person who's in charge of lab safety protocols, right? Why? Because they decided that the whole COVID policy was just about sort of campus safety. So the fire chief was designing our COVID protocols and designing the process for determining whether or not people got exemptions or not. I have a former student of mine who was working at a private university. He submitted a religious exemption. Some 27-year-old Smith grad who, you know, is like some low-level staffer in the human resources office at this huge university denied his religious exemption and said she didn't think that he thought that he had a legitimate religious exemption. So think about that. Think about how absurd that is that we have those kind of people making these sorts of decisions about other people's health. In my case, my PhD immunologist, who had 65 peer-reviewed publications, had to have his work checked by the fire chief of the university to determine whether or not I was entitled to exemption. Just crazy.
I could go on with all the examples that I accumulated over the couple of years. One of my favorites comes from here in Florida in Alachua County. They had some rule early on for, I guess, retail stores, and it was something like you could have one person per 100 square feet. And so people were wondering, where's the science behind that? And Todd, let me just, I want you to brace yourself, okay? Brace yourself, right. Prepare that there is no science, okay?
No.
You already knew that, okay? And it turns out the answer was, 100's a nice round number, so it makes the math easy for everybody. I'm not kidding. That's what they said. That's what the board said.
That's right.
That's the reason. So,
but
don't you get people saying to you, you may be an expert in some area of law, but you're not an expert in this, so you're not entitled to an opinion, so shut your mouth.
Absolutely. People say that all the time. And I say then, believe it or not, here's all the data. Here's all the studies. I've read hundreds of studies. I mean, you follow my Twitter feed, Tom. Probably your eyes at some point glaze over with all the studies that I'm citing, right? They say, here's the studies, here's the evidence. And here's what I'll say is, if you go back and you read my complaint in my lawsuit or my Wall Street Journal article from last summer, literally everything that I said at the time has turned out to be true. And literally everything that my critics said at the time has turned out to be false. I don't know what people think the public health community is, and I'm not sure what all these different credentials are supposed to mean. People can believe me or they can not believe me. I've shown my work. I've shown what the data is. You know, and I think my track record has been pretty good if people go back and look at, you know, the things that I said then and have said since then. And I think everything that has been said the other way around, criticizing my position, has been a complete and abysmal failure. And it's really just been an unwillingness of judges to step up to the plate in a lot of these cases and really, you know, stand up for individual rights. And this is why I've gotten very passionate about the legal part of this, Tom, is that the science and the law does have to go together, because we have a right to bodily autonomy that's been recognized by the Supreme Court. Why do we have that? The reason is, back a century ago, when the progressives and public health community were running American public health, they had these laws based on eugenics. In a famous case called Buck versus Bell, which the Supreme Court affirmed 8-1, said that so-called feeble-minded people could be sterilized, forcibly sterilized against their will, in order to prevent them from reproducing because of the, quote, externalities, unquote, that they would impose on society. And as you probably know, this is where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes had his famous line, 3 generations of imbeciles is enough. A legal doctrine that's broad enough to require compulsory vaccination against smallpox surely also allows you to tie the fallopian tubes of somebody who the public health community thinks shouldn't be allowed to reproduce based on eugenics. That's the slippery slope that these judges allow us to be on. And if you're going to just defer to the public health community, then you're saying that Buck versus Bell is correctly decided. And I don't think most Americans believe that. I know I don't. And I don't think the Supreme Court does or would either. In which case, then you really have to understand the science and you have to dig into the science. You can't just defer to these public health officials when they pop off about something that seems to be as much politics as anything else.
I think you anticipated one of my questions, which was, how has your experience affected your personal scholarly research agenda?
Yeah, and it really has directed me in that direction, Tom, which is, you know, I think like a lot of us, we've become much more skeptical of these claims of authority and expertise. Interestingly enough, this is dovetailed with a pre-existing sort of scholarly agenda I had, which is, we talked about at the beginning, I do a lot of consumer finance and financial regulation. And of course, the 2008 financial crisis is sort of the financial regulation equivalent to this, right? Which is what it's really brought back to me is the importance of taking on the progressive regulatory state directly, which is, it's really highlighted for me the extent to which so much of the modern kind of tyranny and undermining the Constitution is based on these progressive ideas of expertise and adaptability. And, you know, basically, we have to give the government power to control society. And it's really reaffirmed to me that that's both bad for individual liberty, but also just bad policy, which is these complex adaptive orders like immunology and the way the virus has evolved so rapidly by selecting for it to escape these narrowly targeted vaccinations, right, which was pretty obvious, or the way in which the financial system a decade ago adapted to the and were kind of selected create a financial crisis by the central planning tendencies of the way financial regulation was done. We need to really rethink the way we approach regulation in the modern age, because we have far exceeded the limits of central planning. Just take a simple example, which is think about the idea that these narrowly targeted vaccines against this quickly mutating virus, that somehow that single point intervention can solve this problem, right? That's like saying that you can impose a minimum wage and nothing else will happen in the economy, right? It's an evolutionary system, and so much of modern society is like that. It's really brought back to me recognition of first principles of the importance of the rule of law and a framework for free individuals to adjust and adapt to a complex environment.
I feel like the accepted narrative about COVID is, as the years go on, going to take a real beating. Not that it does us a lot of good now, but right. I feel like there's no way in half a century or much sooner, but let's say 50, 100 years from now in particular, when everybody with a vested interest in this, whose career depends on being a liar, will have gone to his reward, we'll put it that way. There's nobody's going to say wearing a mask really did a lot. You know, 'cause it's just impossible. No way. Right. Because, I mean, for one thing, we mentioned the transportation thing. You're allowed to pull your mask down to take a bite of peanuts or something. Okay, now, if they really thought the masks were urgently necessary, they would ban the damn peanuts from the flight.
Right.
They wouldn't say you can pull your mask down and have some peanuts and pull them back up. It's not urgent that when I go from Florida to Boston, I have to have peanuts during that 2.5 hour flight or I'm just going to drop dead. You know, so the fact that we're being so frivolous about it, or we would have told all men with beards to shave them.
Right.
Because if you have a beard, there's no possible way that mask can work. So it goes to show they're not even really taking themselves seriously. And yet they act like, if you try going to a Broadway show today, have fun. Because yeah. if you sip too long, there is somebody who gets right in your face about putting that mask back up. Well, that sounds like a wonderful night out with your sweetheart, right?
Right. Yeah, I hope you're right, Tom. And this is where the battle of ideas really does matter and the universities do matter, right? Which is that we have to keep fighting this war. I mean, think about it. I would have thought after 2008 and the financial crisis, the idea of government bailouts and what those guys did was useful.
Okay, yeah, that's true. This is a good counterexample.
Yeah,
because I also wondered to myself, it could also turn out to be like the Great Depression, where the conventional wisdom is still that it wasn't the government's fault, they did the best they could do, it was monetary policy or something like that, or that there was too much inequality in the economy and so people couldn't afford to buy the goods being produced. But there'd be a strong, strong dissident tradition.
Right.
But I think this might wind up being more like the war in Iraq, where even the initial boosters
right.
have to sort of admit, okay, well, based on the information we had, I think a lot of them will try to back out of it with, based on the information we had, blah, 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 we were just doing our best.
And I hope that's right. And, you know, one of the advantages to that that makes us more like the war in Iraq than everything else is that the government pushed this so far for so long that literally it's become obvious that everything they did was such an utter failure and had such catastrophic consequences that it's hard to ignore, right? Which is, for the financial crisis, this sort of alternative reality, sort of the what-if world, is hard to imagine, right? When they say, well, the whole global economy would have collapsed, they don't have anything to back that up. But at the same time, it's kind of hard to, you don't really have that alternative reality. Where here, we know that everything they've done has been a complete and utter catastrophic failure, that it's been expensive, that it's destroyed lives, that it's destroyed our kids' lives. And so there is a sense in which it's much harder, going to be much harder for them to run from their path of failure here than it did like for the financial crisis. And so in that way, it is much more like the Iraq war, and I hope that's the case. Nevertheless, you know, I just read over the weekend, universities now are bringing back mask mandates after they had gotten rid of them, basically. And kids on universities have been really skittish about this. You would have thought the university kids would be opposed to all this sort of stuff, but a lot of them just kind of fall in a line. And so, you know, and they'll be the ones who will be sort of becoming our, you know, thought leaders over time. So I think we need to keep fighting this and keep contesting it and keep reminding people of what, you know, disastrous failures all these policies were.
I'll tell you something. The thing that concerns me the most is precisely that people who grew up as kids in this environment and observed everything that happened are inevitably going to come to the conclusion that this is not entirely abnormal. This is something that could be done once in a while. The state can step in and tell you to do X and Y and tell you not to do A and B. I don't want to be ruled over by people who had that experience and who never questioned it and never heard a dissenting voice. You know, so that is a major, major danger. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute for me to give you some very, very valuable advice. This is advice that is going to score you a lot of points with your spouse or significant other. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. That person you love is going to be so impressed by your creativity and thoughtfulness. And you don't even have to say, I got the idea from Woods. I'm just giving this to you. You can run with it. You can act like it was your idea. That's fine. Whatever promotes happiness and happy relationships in the world is fine with me. And of course, what I'm talking about is the wonderful Happily Date Box, which I've been receiving for nearly 3 years now. Every month, you get an amazing box filled with interesting, fun activities that you can do with your significant other. It's a way to have a date night in. You get a music playlist, maybe a little project to work on, games to play, questions that provoke deep and meaningful conversations, intimate moments that bring the two of you together. They're just wonderful. You're just going to love them. And when you say, hey, I subscribed us to this Happily Date Box service, you're just going to be looked at with a loving gaze. You're going to have that loving gaze into your eyes like, ah, I knew I was right choosing you. Okay? You want to get that gaze? You can get that at tomwoods.com/date. Not to mention, if you go to tomwoods.com/date, you get 50% off your first date. So what possible reason would you have? What, do you not like having a loving gaze in your eyes? Come on. So head over to tomwoods.com/date, get 50% off your first date, enjoy time together, and you are welcome. Before I let you go, I want to transition to something else just very quickly because I know you've been doing work on it and it's a subject of concern to people who listen to this show. You've been talking about the topic of so-called cancel culture as it relates to banking. Now, of course, we've seen that in the case of Canada with the trucker convoy. And you do hear isolated cases in the U.S. of people who are just banned from using the banking system or payment processing and whatever. Where do you think this is going? What's your view on this?
Yeah, and what's scary about this, Tom, is again, it's the regulatory state in action, right? And the financial regulatory system is in many ways the apotheosis of the regulatory state in the sense that there is virtually nothing that resembles the rule of law within the financial regulatory system. And so what I've seen sort of growing up over time is this alliance between sort of that we've seen elsewhere, sort of woke corporations, progressive activists, and the government using these sort of regulation by raised eyebrows sorts of approaches. And we saw this during the Obama administration under something called Operation Choke Point, where the Obama administration basically used its powers to cause the government to stop providing financial services to completely legal industries that the Obama administration didn't like, most notably payday lenders, for example, but also gun dealers, ammunition dealers, and some other groups. And so now what that's done is come back in a different version, which is leaning on banks to not provide banking services to certain industries and individuals. So, for example, we know that banks have been pressured to stop providing financial services to fossil fuel companies, oil companies, that sort of thing, right? They even nominated originally for the head of the control of the currency that woman who said she would bankrupt the fossil fuels industry through the financial system. But more and more what they've been doing is they've been shutting off financial services to groups that are deemed to be hate groups or that they just don't like or that sort of thing. And so I wrote a column in Newsweek in January that summed up some of my thoughts on this that people could find. And literally the day after my column was published, it was announced that Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, was getting all of his bank accounts canceled by his bank, not just his personal one, but the company and his nonprofits and that sort of thing. And then just a few weeks later, we saw what happened in Canada, where the government basically told people, basically cracked down on the truckers in terms of freezing their bank accounts. And if you think about where this leads, Tom, if the rationale is, well, you broke the law, and so we're allowed to freeze your bank accounts. One of the things that happened there, for example, was one woman was given bail by the court, but she wasn't allowed to access her bank account to post bail. Think about if you could do that here. The Eighth Amendment right to bail is completely useless if you can't access your bank accounts. Think about what it would be like if Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, if people had said, well, these guys are, you know, engaged in law breaking. They're engaged in trespassing, encouraging people to sit at lunch counters or walking across the Selma Bridge. So you're not allowed to donate to that organization because they're promoting breaking the law and that sort of thing. If you think about where that leads, pretty quickly you see that if you can't get a bank account, if you can't receive money, that has very serious consequences for constitutional rights and democracy. And that's what we saw in Canada, which is what happened in Canada could happen here, I think, in terms of, you know, how this might all play out. And so they just might not be as transparent about it as it was there. But it is already happening here, Tom, in an under-the-radar sort of way. And this is in many ways even worse than social media because of the fact that you can't just start a new bank, right? You have to get authorized to start a new bank and that sort of thing. And so I think it's something we need to be aware of in terms of nipping this problem in the bud and making sure that people don't lose their ability to purchase goods, to purchase groceries, and nonprofits don't end up losing their ability to be able to raise funds to do the things that they need to do.
I think the real concern here is that this is happening simultaneously with a campaign to demonize people with certain political views. So therefore, there aren't going to be the kind of robust responses to this that you might have otherwise. That because the way people, you know, I mean, obviously we know the way Trump voters are thought of. These aren't even people. I mean, these people are so reprehensible that more or less whatever happens to them, they have coming to them. Now, they're not going to put it quite that way. I mean, no judge is going to say it quite that way. But the polarization and the demonization are so deep and profound that you could easily see it driving this kind of thing, which is why I support a society that has a classically liberal outlook that just looks at people blindly as people and says that they're entitled to certain protections regardless of who they are or what they think. And now that's like some crazy, extreme right-wing position. But this is the position that free societies have held on to forever. And that's going away because the idea is that now there is an exception. If you have deplorable views, you know, you probably deserve this. Or it would be kind of like what Herbert Marcuse said about tolerance. You know, we cannot tolerate the intolerant. So we're not actually betraying our principles. This never was our principle. We never had the principle that people like this are entitled to certain protections. No, they're destroying the body politic with their toxic views. And so what follows from that is that we can more or less do what we as a society form a consensus that we want to do. This can't possibly lead to a happy outcome.
That is so well said, Tom, and I agree completely. You know, my observation about this is it always starts with the Nazis, right? It's like, well, surely you don't think that a bank should have to provide a bank account to somebody selling Nazi paraphernalia, right? But then we've seen where this leads. We saw where it led on university campuses, which starts at the Nazis, and pretty soon you have George Will being canceled, right? They just keep bringing in the fences. And so here you start with the Nazis, and you know, next thing you know, the MyPillow guy can't get a bank account, right? Or, you know, they canceled the payment processing for a group in Missouri who was going to host a speech by Donald Trump Jr. And JP Morgan Chase said, well, we don't provide payment processing for hate groups, right? Which is, it doesn't just stop with the Nazis. And so that's what they do. And so I think your point is right on, Tom, which is it has to be a principled position. And here's what I think is the larger picture that concerns me is we live in a system of democratic capitalism, and that requires certain tolerance, which is to say, Milton Friedman, the great economist, said, you know, one of the beautiful things about the free market system is we don't care whether our grain was grown by a Jew, a Muslim, or a Christian, right? Or a Republican or a Democrat, right? Which is the marketplace, traditionally what we thought is, can you meet my needs for the least cost and in the most pleasant sort of way? And now this intertwining of, you know, that if we're going to destroy your business for positions you take politically, and that this intertwining of your right to make a living with your ability to speak your mind in the public square, I think is very dangerous and needs to be attacked, like you're saying, at the level of principle. Because as soon as you say, well, what about the Nazis? You know, like I said, it's a pretty quick slippery slope that they pull from the Nazis to George Will being canceled, or from the Nazis to Mike Lindell, right? Basically, because they don't like their political views. And there's no logical stopping point there.
Right, right, right. And, you know, you try to warn progressives, and I don't bother because there's no point, but you warn them, someday this could be you, and their view is that'll never happen, so I don't care. I mean, my people, let's see, dominate the law schools, of academia, the entertainment world, the standing bureaucracy, the political class, the CEOs of all the major companies. I'm not worried that this is going to happen to me. We are in the saddle. I don't care what populist red wave there is. We are where it counts. So I don't care. I'm going to do what I need to do. I think that's their attitude.
I agree completely. We've been trying to explain to them, or to explain them, tell them for 20 years, this is why you shouldn't have speech codes on campus. And they just laugh, right? Because they know the speech codes never get turned against them. And so they are completely unprincipled. They're completely concerned about power. Like you said, they have the whip hand now and they're going to use it. And I think it's time that we at least acknowledge that, to start thinking about it and stop pretending like we can persuade them to be decent and principled, because I think that is a losing strategy as far as I can tell.
How do people follow your work?
So you can follow me on Twitter. I do write a lot of op-eds and that sort of thing. So probably Twitter's the best place to look for me, at Todd Zawicki. And they can find my personal webpage, has all my articles on it and that sort of thing. So I'd love to hear from people.
Great. All right. I'll link to that all at tomwoods.com/2114. And it's Todd, Z-Y-W-I-C-K-I.
That's right.
For people looking for you. Well, thanks, Todd, for taking the time today and for the important work you've been doing. Could you imagine if we had a country where the academics were all Todd's Wiki? How great that would be. We'd have an awful lot of studies about interest rate caps on credit cards, but that's fine.
We can never have too many of those. Some of those lessons need to be relearned again and again and again, right, Tom?
Yes. You know, by the way, I'll just say one final thing. Being an academic, but particularly in the field of economics, you know, that we have all the standard things about academia that make you crazy, but there's something particularly about economics that no matter how hard you work your whole career, you're lying on your deathbed in the hospital and the nurse who's attending to you comments on the news and she's just repeating some economic fallacy you devoted your life to overturning. And there you are on your deathbed wondering, was it all worth it?
What if I've wasted my life? It's about right. Yes, these bad ideas just keep coming back, don't they?
That's right. Well, thanks again, Todd. I really appreciate it.
Great. Great to talk to you, Tom. Thanks.
All right, folks. Tomorrow on the program, Gene Epstein comes back, and we're going to answer a question that I've gotten quite a bit over the years. Every time we see articles indicating that there's some remote possibility that the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar might be threatened, people want to know what effect that would have on them if that were ever to happen. So we are finally going to give you a good, solid answer to that question. So make sure and join us. And if you like and appreciate the old Tom Woods Show, then join me as a supporting listener. You will not believe all the goodies you get as a supporting listener. You'd be like a kid in a candy store when you head over to supportinglisteners.com. Thank you guys for helping to make the Tom Woods Show happen. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.